Welcome to Horse First with Lockie Phillips, a podcast about paying closer attention to the horse, to the work that we do with horses, and paying attention to what's actually happening in front of us. Not what looks good, not what we've been told looks good, because sometimes we slow down and sometimes we speed up, but we don't pretend. I'm Lockie Phillips. Let's begin. Hello, Michelle.
Hello, Lockie.
How are you today?
I am doing well. I'm excited to be here chatting with you again because it's one of my favorite places to be.
Yeah, chatting with you is one of my favorite things to do. So those of anyone listening who do not know who you are or who we are to each other, just bring us up to speed real quick.
Sure. The little Cliff Notes version is I am Michelle Knapp. Well, we've established that. And we work together in emotional horsemanship. I think we've been collaborating strongly for 3 years or so now. Me and Time have a funny relationship, so I'm trying to remember on the spot here. But yeah, we've been collaborating.
About 3 years.
Yeah, about 3 years. And living in Southwest Wisconsin on my little farm with my husband, working with my little happy horse herd, and also able to collaborate on working with the global emotional horsemanship community via collaborating with you. So I'm here as a long horse lover and advocate of horse first horse keeping and horse first horse training and horse first horse peopling.
Yeah. You are someone that I respect and value both personally and professionally, and you helped solve a big problem for me. And that was an overflow of people asking me for lessons and support. I couldn't teach another lesson. I was teaching more lessons than I could. And so we're sharing the load, and we've got people in our community who like my work, but prefer, frankly, working with you. And that's correct and awesome to have other voices working alongside me. So yeah, I'm so grateful for you.
Well, I'm double grateful for you because those lessons that you were needing help in taking care of were lessons that I absolutely needed to create a thriving business and a sense of satisfaction in working with people who are interested in the things that light me up. So
yeah,
it's pretty phenomenal.
So we're here to talk around a little post I wrote. There'll be people who potentially are watching this video who aren't aware of the post, and that's good. And I'm glad if they aren't. And there'll be people watching who are aware. But I wrote a post recently that I called Too Much Turnout. That was the title. Mm-hmm. And it went a little bit bananas. And
you blew up the internet a little bit.
Well, we called each other. I think I called you, but you had called me. Anyway, we were chatting and then we FaceTimed on the evening after I wrote it while I was making dinner. And we were just like chatting about what was going on. But it went bananas, and I've had a lot of direct messages from people saying, you know, oh my God, thank you for writing this. I've been seeing it too. I've been frightened to speak about it. I also received significant criticism. And I think some of that criticism was ideological. Some of it became personal, which I don't think is particularly useful. And I'm going to try and not to address the personal criticism because I don't think that's a good use of anyone's time. But most of it was really good criticism. And that's what I want to talk about today, because I don't want to become someone who advises us to let go of rigid thinking only to turn around and then a few days after I wrote a post rigidly defend everything I've ever written. That's not what I'm here to do. So I want to do three things today. I want to take a look at where I think the post was weak. I want to explain why, nevertheless, it was a weak post. Nevertheless, I stand behind the central observation that caused me to write it. And then I want to get to what I think is the more interesting conversation, and that's about turnout, rest, movement, recovery, training, and the individual horse, and how all of those things can intersect. So we're going to read the post in a moment. I'll read the post out in a second. But when you first read it, Michelle, what made you uncomfortable about it, if anything? Don't hold back.
Mm-hmm. When I first opened it and I saw the title, I went, oh, that's going to ruffle some feathers. But right after that, I know you a little bit, and
A
I've been
little.
around a little bit, and I thought, this is going to be interesting because this is going to be mainly a call to look deeper and think deeper about something. So after that initial, oh, this is going to ruffle some feathers, I have to get a little bit ready because by nature I'm someone who wants everyone to be comfortable. So I knew that was not going to be the case. And as I was reading, I think the thing that made me, that was pretty much it. That was the thing that made me uncomfortable, was right at the beginning when it said too much turnout. I went, uh-oh, that's
Uh-oh.
because I have faith in your
Context.
processes. And I know you're not going to put something out if you don't have a core nugget of something really valuable that you believe in. So then I got interested and curious at what's going on here and what's driving. So that was my initial, I think, if I'm remembering. You know, it's been a little bit of an exciting time between now and then. We've been talking about it a lot. So that was my initial reaction.
Yeah, when I went ahead and wrote the post, I was in the middle of a creative process. I'm simultaneously writing my first book and also creating a new group coaching program that's being launched in about a month. And one of the focus subjects in the group coaching program is the issue of teaching horses how to move forward without sticks, without whips, without excessive reinforcement, just to show them the benefit of movement. And having studied this across a large caseload of clients now, you and I together, we often come across this as a big hurdle for a lot of horses. Horses that, when you ask quietly, just find it really hard to go. And when you optimize your aids, they still find it hard to go. And so I'm trying to look at this subject like a scientist or like a nerd. I'm trying to look at the subject of the horse who struggles to move. And I'm trying to look at it from as many angles as possible. And the more I looked at it, I found this perspective on it that I feel like hasn't been looked at very often. And it was a very narrow perspective. And then I went ahead and I wrote on it. And I realized that that process I'm in is not available to the people who read it. So let me go ahead and read the post. Is that okay? Yeah. All right. 5th of August at 12:38, so just after midday. Too much turnout. All capital letters. Sidebar. I wonder if I had written too much turnout, question mark, how that might have changed things.
The
But
same thing.
yeah. And I haven't gone back to edit it, except for spelling. I've left it how it is because the criticism it brought is important too. Anyway, too much turnout. This is a silent epidemic, and I have been a bit reticent to talk about it, but here we go. I am preparing training plans and sequencing designed to adapt to individual horses and people for a 3-month program. Our primary focus is on creating forward, free-moving horses that are happy to move, then focusing on their sense of collection, softness, and quickness. I have chosen these focus subjects this year after studying the cases of hundreds of horses and their people worldwide, and found a big problem. Horses are refusing to move forward unless you use a whip, spur, force at some level. This is a problem. There are solutions. Pause. Do we teach whip, spur to go forward, Michelle,
No, we
in our
do not.
organization? In
No.
fact, I've ruffled probably equally, if not more, feathers writing against these things.
Fair to say.
Lost a lot of business around my stance on whips. But what happens to a horse to cause them to consistently refuse to take a step or enjoy going forward so that they can work on their collection, their strength, their talents? One of nature's most kinesthetic and movement-loving beings suddenly reduced to stone unless we force them somehow. Where did we go wrong? Online, we see a lot of very important and correct advocacy work around turning horses out. Because at a mainstream level, there are still large percentages of the horse-owning population that do not. They keep horses in boxes. This is inappropriate. Some horses live in tiny chicken coops or stalls unless ridden. The advocacy work to give horses space and turnout is vital because the health problems for horses who cannot freely move are serious. But over here in my work, people who lock horses in stalls do not come to Lockie or my team for help. We repel them. We feel unwelcoming to them. Because you best believe we will not collude with folks committed to locking horses away. That accountability is terrifying to them. So they don't work with me, us. Michelle, would that be a fair representation of the people who work with us so far?
From what I've seen, yes, absolutely. Because there's so much that you put out about what a horse needs in their species appropriate life before we would ever enter into a training relationship.
Mm-hmm. This side of the fence, ... all in capital letters. My clients turn their horses out as much as they can, all of them. On this side of the fence, I am seeing the other side of the turnout problem, too much turnout. Work on a problem long enough, you learn that the spectrum is in fact a circle. What I am seeing, horses that have so much turnout that they have become exhausted by it. So when we come to work together with them in training, they have no gas in the tank. Their good anti-inflammatory diets, low in calorie and forage-based, give them enough to live outside, but not enough juice to overflow with energy that we can ethically work with in training. Their paddocks and turnouts have shelters, but their shelters are often dark, dead ends they wouldn't dare sleep in. They face into wind, or lack bedding to lay comfortably down in. Or their herds are complex enough that some members worry about laying down lest another horse come and push them around. Day by day, the sleep deprivation adds up, and within 1 year or two, we start to see inflammatory disease, autoimmune system symptoms, loss of vitality, and in training, horses that collapse. We have turned turnout into a new job, and our horses are often becoming tired of it. Natural horsekeeping dogma pontificates against rugs and espouses the wonder of a horse's natural coat, which is true. And yet, I so frequently see horses wind tired or limb cold or stiff bodied from bracing against rain in the winter. When I recommend rugs, sometimes I am seen as a traitor to the natural horsekeeping movement, as if providing additional support is anthropomorphic. And yet, with my own horses, some of them need rugs all year. Some need almost none. Almost. And if I want my horses to have energy to train and create movement with me, rugging them in hard weather or against bugs helps them have the physical and mental capacity to give. Horses cannot pour from an empty or draining cup. This is not a 100% rule. Generally, horses living in turnout are happier and healthier than horses that do not. I am just saying that from where I am standing, some of us have over and our horses. Hooves too, they need to move. And also, how many horses have hooves that grow slower than they wear down? A hoof that is tired from use is going to ruin movement quality in their training. Do not hesitate to protect and boot. Recently, me and my team realized that two of my four horses had reached their maximum turnout capacity. Everything about them was asking for structured rest. So we built a stable and created 3 to 4 hours of structured daily rest in a stall. Hay, water, friends on the other side of the door, guaranteed food, water shade, and solo time. A bit like an introvert retreating to recharge. I have noticed increased capacity, mental acuity, and vitality. Structured rest, not locking horses away. Structured rest, not all need it. Can you tell the difference? So, if you are out there on this side of natural horsekeeping, you know horses should be turned out as much as possible, but you suspect your horse is overexposed, I want to validate you. You're probably right. The things us naturalists have tried to demonize are now actually your best strategies to offering your horse support so their cup can overflow with well-being again. Rugging, booting, extra energetic feed, turn in, time out, social rest without social isolation, more consistent schedule, removal from weather, better bedding, better shelter, protection from elements. These things are only inappropriate if overdone, the same way natural keeping can be overdone. In our effort to put the horse first, there are no sacred cows. So remember that no singular approach, rule, or idea is a perfect gospel. Put the horse first and you will be amazed at the things you will reconsider as helpful for your horse's well-being. Okay, there it is.
Good job.
May I never have to read it, right? So The title was provocative. Agreed?
Yes. Yes. And also the next sentence about it being a silent epidemic.
Yeah.
Those were
now,
hard.
What I've been accused of is intentionally being provocative. I really wasn't. When I wrote it, this was genuine, authentically how I felt and thought about it, without any filter, without any mask, without trying to manipulate it so that it would please people. I was simply speaking straight, honestly, to what I thought in that moment. In retrospect, absolutely, I can see that is provocative. But at the moment I wrote it, that's not what I was experiencing. The notion that I was being provocative for clickbait is a warranted concern. However, this post, quote unquote, performed well, not as well as posts I've done in the past about better subjects, but it performed well with the wrong type of person that I want to engage with. It performed well with outrage. Outrage communities. And outrage communities never become a client or a student, and I don't make any money off outrage, if that's what people were thinking I was doing. And actually, the post completely crashed the algorithm on my social media, because the outrage community came in and reported my page, and I'm currently under a shadow ban for writing this post. So actually, this post was terrible for business, terrible for the algorithm. Now, I have a bunch of people who are signing up for this program anyway, and the signups have continued with a little bit of a intake, a little bit of a pause, and then the signups continued. But it was not good for my algorithm. It was not good for community growth. It was not good for business growth. None of that accusation that I was doing it for that is founded, because that's not what's happening and it's not what I was doing it for. But I can see, absolutely, I can empathize with that point of view. What other things have you and I worked on, or have you seen me work on in the past, other than this subject, are potentially outrageous?
I just wanted to point to what you were just saying, if I could, for a moment, that
yeah.
I think there's a really big difference between a post, and I agree with you, it's absolutely understandable why people felt it was potentially intentionally inflammatory. But we did notice that mostly those were not the individuals who were familiar with your voice and with your style of writing and your style of communicating. That was in general not the response, because I think one of the big strengths that you have, Lockie, is your ability to illuminate blind spots, even within your own closest knit communities.
Within myself.
Yeah, to be able to illuminate those blind spots without being completely hindered by the worry of upsetting people.
No, and that's a very nice way to say I piss people off on a regular basis.
You now, do, but you're not intentionally trying to piss people off. I'm saying, hold on, because this is an important point, I think. It didn't come across to those of us who are familiar with your voice as being said for the sake of being inflammatory. It felt there like it was being said for the sake of it feeling very important to you, and therefore not being filtered or couched. And I think that's an important distinction.
Right. Also potentially a little over-caffeinated just after midday.
You should start to have, you could have little emoji warnings on that. There could be like three cups of coffee at the top.
This is a 4-cup post. Just beware. Buckle up. Also, there are people who were familiar with my voice who were reading it, but they were familiar with it in a manner that they don't like it, haven't liked it for a long time, and they monitor my work so that they can pounce on the first opportunity to spread outrage about it. And That's important too. I should be up for rigorous cross-examination around people who are critical of my work. That's good and healthy. So it's a provocative title, but the problem is if you took away the title and just put the post as it is, even the second title, and if I just took away those first two lines, the post would read a lot better, because A, it wouldn't immediately algorithmically direct it towards an outrage community.
Sure.
So that would be that. And then I think most of the core premise stands up, because very quickly I say the important advocacy work around turning horses out. It's inappropriate to keep horses in boxes. Over here, people who lock horses in stalls. Do not come to me and my team for help. We repel them. We're unwelcoming to them because we will not collude with folks committed to locking horses away. I say that very quickly. However, I was speaking from one side of a fence and then the Facebook algorithm removed the fence. And right. What it looked like was that Lockie is asking us to turn our horses in, feed them up, and then train them. What? Mm-hmm. That's what it looked like, because the algorithm annihilates the nuance required to actually see what I was talking about.
Well, it makes it a little harder. It puts the burden on the person reading to discern and to think critically if they want to, if they want to.
If they want to. To be clear, I'm not arguing that horses need less turnout. I'm arguing that maximum turnout and optimum welfare are not automatically synonymous for every individual horse in every individual environment. Perfect turnout does not exist. That would have been a better title. Perfect turnout does not exist. Even if you go to optimize the shelters, optimize the bedding, optimize the social environment, there comes a limit where you can't keep upping it. We cannot allow communities to bankrupt themselves constructing better track systems or building in better shelters. If you're in boarding environments, maybe you can't. Maybe if you're running a boarding environment, you can't, because we all know horse boarding doesn't make any money.
We do know this.
And at some point, there's not enough land in many countries and too many horses, and horses need to be accommodated. Would I prefer a horse be in a small run than in a box forever? Yes. Would I prefer that both of those environments aren't present? Of course. But in situations where you've lost as much as you can your turnout and the horse is still not thriving, we need to look at other tools in our toolbox.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think one of those other elements that was being illuminated from that is people who are familiar with the work of emotional horsemanship are familiar with how often the topic of get a diagnosis comes up. When a horse is not feeling well or 100%, and how strongly and how often you advocate for that throughout. I mean, that is a very thread throughout all of our lessons and coaching calls, throughout your group coaching programs, through any of your content. That is a very easy thread to find. And that was one of the criticisms that I was seeing, you know, of the post, is that, well, this is looking for of training energy or extraction of availability of energy from the horse. And this is why it's a problem. You know, like, well, we need to look at the other potential. What if this is pain related?
So right.
That was one of those things that if people are familiar at all coming at this post from a place of being familiar with where you're standing and where the whole team and the whole ethos really is, that's all taken into account before this thread.
Because people will read the title and they will hear Lockie is saying turnout is bad. That's not what I wrote, but it's an extremely easy reduction of what I wrote. The deeper problem that we're talking about is primarily that I was talking to an already converted population where the last horse has been turned out, while Facebook or the algorithm distributed the post far beyond that population of people who have already turned the horse out. My sentence that I said on this side of the fence is crucial context, but algorithms don't preserve context. And one of the contexts that I didn't write about in the post that you would have to already know about me explicitly is that I wake up in the morning and my first thought is no horse in the world has to be trained.
Right.
That's my first thought in the morning. I have very good friendships with people who are anti-training. And on a school call, I think 2 weeks ago, was giving anti-training advice to people who had overtrained horses. So teaching them, giving them strategies such as go through the tacking up process with this horse who's a little sour about work, go through the grooming, the haltering, the leading, the tying up, the tacking up, the everything, come into the arena, make a big fuss about it, get them to position the mounting block, mount and sit, do nothing. 2 minutes, do absolutely nothing, ask nothing. Dismount, give them cookies and take them for a hand graze, maybe, because this horse has been overdone. So, you know, people would have to have known that about me already. And I understand how it comes across like Lockie's trying to coercively set up training availability in horses. No, no horse has to be trained. However, those of us who train are now burdened with a very big responsibility to do this as best as we can with the horse's best interest. And my question is not, how do I get what I want in training? It is, how can this horse thrive in training? And how mm-hmm. can training be something the horse looks forward to? And how can it be better than off turnout? Because how I believe can training, it can be.
How can training pour into their cup?
Pour it, offer them more joy and interest and vitality than even the most optimized turnout could offer. And I believe that that's possible because I've lived it myself. And so that's the side of the fence I'm talking from, the algorithm of the fence, and spread the post far beyond our communities. So that's where the post was weak. Also, there were several claims that I made that were stronger than the evidence that I presented. And this is a very legitimate vulnerability in the post, and it's an area I need to be less careless about. I went from professional observations based on large caseload, very large caseload. Believe me, you and I are working very hard on the size of my caseload. I need my caseload to just let me breathe. It's been several years of a case. Okay, so mm-hmm. we went from observations based on my professional caseload about inadequate rest, weather exposure, low vitality, into potential medical statements such as inflammatory disease, autoimmune symptoms, sleep deprivation, limb cold, yes. whatever that yeah. means, hoof fatigue, diet, and available training energy. These are reasonable hypotheses or observations from my professional caseload and my professional experience, which is what I was writing about. However, the post itself, because of the way social media operates, presents causal relationships with more confidence than the post is able to substantiate. Causation is a correlation is not causation, right? There's a potential that the observations I'm seeing, horses with bizarre autoimmune issues, sleep deprivation issues, tired limbs, wind fatigue, inflammatory diseases, it's potential that these are only correlated but not causated by too much turnout. What I was saying is, in my professional observation, a potential cause, a potential mm-hmm. causal factor of these issues, one of thousands of potential causal factors, could be overexposure in their lifestyle, as much as we often associate too much stabling as a causal factor to a horse's disease burden. And I think it's foolish for us to not consider both sides of the horsekeeping issue as causal factors towards any disease. And I think we don't talk about that. However, the problem with the post is that it presented it as evidence mm-hmm. when in fact it was just me making a professional observation. And that's making me liable to those in our community who are very rigidly scientifically minded, and we need them. A scientifically minded critic would be able to very quickly attack the medical claims, unfairly or otherwise, and use that to discredit my wider body of work. So my position is, actually, I am observing this pattern repeatedly in my client population. My position is not X causes Y.
That's an important distinction.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And people need to know that about me, that I'm very rarely kind of teaching from a set of commandments mm-hmm. or formulas. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a really helpful distinction that you make, because I didn't get personally that impression of
it became a diagnosis. Apparent to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I can absolutely see how that could easily be assumed.
Yeah. 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 Also, the post challenges practices that have become markers of morality.
Yes.
And that's difficult for people. And I could do better to appreciate, in this difficult era we live in, that those markers of morality are really important to certain people. They're not to me, because I get my morality somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And I don't need to quantify that here now to anyone, right? But I need to appreciate that for some people, their practices, what they do, is who they are. And I had that discussion with Remy Burley on the podcast. He said, as a behaviorist, who I am is what I do. And what I do is who I am. That mm-hmm. the identity is totally linked there. Mm-hmm. And no one had said it to me quite that way before, and it's lived rent-free in my head ever since. So Remy, if you're listening, thank you for that. So things like turnout, barefoot management, forage-based diet, minimal rugging, giving horses choice, all the choices, in fact, every choice is theirs. They're not really, or not simply, management choices in some communities anymore.
Right, right.
What are they then? If they're not just a management choice, what?
It becomes an expression of personal identity.
Right.
So when a horse management choice becomes an expression of personal identity, when you see someone challenge that management choice, then it's absolutely easily interpreted as a personal attack.
Yep.
Or at least as a potential pitfall in or your armor of your own personal identity.
Well, it actually directly criticizes their sense of identity and their sense of community. And so they will defend
absolutely
who they are in their community. They will close ranks.
Yeah.
And so I'm not surprised to see that occurring. I wish it wasn't the case. I wish, but there are many things I wish that aren't the case, and I'm not the person to change it. But I make it too psychologically difficult because I'm not just saying, in their eyes, I'm not just saying some horses need a little adaptation in their management choices. They hear me saying, are you an ethical horse person?
Mm-hmm.
When in fact that's mm-hmm. at the core of how they live. They wake up in the morning and that's who they are.
Right. But here's the thing. I hear what you're saying, but I think there are so many voices out there couching to the middle, which is very important. It's basically my lifestyle, being measured, aiming towards the middle. This
you
is
are
like
the most reasonable person I've ever met.
I mean, that's, I find bizarre, but fantastic. But because you, well, it is. That's a core value, right? Because I'm also the weirdest person I know. I've always been such an outlier in every... I'm the shortest. I had the reddest hair. I was the goofiest. I was the most serious. I'm used to being an outlier, but also being the constant bringer backer to middler person.
Mm, okay.
So that's always where I'm just always going to do that. Therefore, because I'm also a very introspective person, I can see the downside to that. And so, yes, for me, if I were going to write your post, it would look very different. But guess what it would not do? It would not provoke meaningful, needle-moving discussion outside of the circle of 10 people that are comfortable with how I say things. So should you have made this more palatable? If you wanted it to be more palatable, then yes. But not everybody likes spicy curry, so don't order it.
What I would have liked to have done is shape it so that it can have maximum impact, but survive being read by the outrage community.
Sure.
That's what I would have liked.
Yes.
It went viral amongst the outrage community because the post had no immunity for them.
Mm.
So they got a virus from it.
Mm.
And I never ever want to cause intentional or unintentional harm. Unintentional matters too.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I can bear criticism. I can bear consequences. Last time I had a post go viral inside the outrage sector of the equestrian world, it ended in a death threat and multiple irate emails, multiple active cancellations citing that post. If you know, you know, I'm not going to discuss what that post was about. This time, no death threats. Score. I think I said that to you when I FaceTimed you and I was cooking dinner. I was like, no death threats this time. We were like, yeah, no death threats this time.
Winning.
And I know it's silly, but that one death threat has really screwed with my head ever since. That's why I've got this crazy waiver for my clinics that cause people to need to like put their ID on the waiver because I'm literally scared of being harmed at a clinic, literally frightened of personal harm.
Yeah, that's no fun.
So it has bugged me and bothered me. But this time, none of that happened, and it seemed that the out stayed inside its own bubble. Had a little bit of a expansion effect, but I think the conversations that they were having were very galvanizing for them and really positive for them based on the post. They united around the common enemy, and the common enemy was Lockie Phillips and his ideas and his whatever, and that was galvanizing for them. And so I love that for them. I actually do. And I think the people I'm focused on are actually equally focused back on me and knew exactly what I was doing. And I don't think there's going to be any long-term harm. But there was another fault I want to mention.
Mm-hmm.
The fault was the topic of our horses need energy if we are going to train them.
Mm-hmm.
They need energy. If you choose to train, there needs to be energy available in the horse for you to make the choice to train ethically. That energy shouldn't be coerced out of them somehow. It needs to be nurtured and supported. So the integument, the argument itself of horses need energy to train is an obvious welfare sticky zone. It creates a potential counter, because my intended argument there was, in my opinion, too sophisticated for the fence removing algorithm, because my argument is that if we are going to ask horses to develop physically, to become creative, to find training as a valuable factor in their life that they look forward to, if we're going to do that, our management of their lives must provide enough recovery, enough nutrition, enough sleep, and enough physical comfort to support that development we chose for them. But someone reading that message from a hostile lens will very easily see Lockie wants horses stalled, rugged, and fed more so that they have enough energy to work for us. But only a hostile reading would see that. Or someone with a bias against training in the first place, or a fundamental deep-seated belief that even the most ethical training is somehow a problem for a horse, and that even ethical training is the best of a bad deal that we can offer. And I think that's a real factor for a lot of the people we live and work with, all this internal conflict about riding, about training. Should I ask horses to do anything? Is it ethical to ride them? All of these things that I personally have no conflict about, and sort of resolutions I've made in myself long, long time ago. I realize not everyone is me, duh, obviously. So there was I presented something that was easily read in a hostile manner. I made myself open to it there.
Yeah. Yes, I agree. That was a thought that was glommed onto as well. That was open for misinterpretation. The background knowledge of how much you already, and we all already fundamentally come from the standpoint of, no, it's not a base entitlement to train a horse at any level.
Nope.
At any level.
No. It's not about increasing the horse's resources for us. It's about ensuring that the horse's life is not depleting them. Because another option is, if your training is depleting them in some manner, stop training them. That's another option, right? And I often advise, I've been at situations in clinics where people have asked a question, they've set up the question, they've explained the problem, explained what they're doing. And my answer was, it sounds like we need to stop doing that. In fact, that's a post that's ruffled feathers. I've written a post like, just stop it. I wrote a post ages ago. It's like, all this discussion about what should I do instead? And my answer is just stop all of it. Right. That's another post that's ruffled feathers.
I mean, you could say the occasional feather ruffle is somewhat on brand.
Well, it's a gross thing to say, brand, but like, it's name one movement in history where positive change occurred and no one got pissed off in the process.
Well, that's what I was going to say. But if we're here to make ourselves only comfortable, we're probably missing out on what's optimal for the horse.
I understand the need for comfort. The world is burning.
Absolutely.
The world is burning.
Well, that's even a need for safety.
Yeah. And I understand that the dangerous aspects of the work we're doing is not going to be palatable to people who are looking for safety, period. Mm-hmm. I understand that. Also, the post criticizes a culture rather than simply examining a management problem. And that's always a little tricky.
Mm.
When I said things like natural horsekeeping dogma pontificates, put those in one sentence, quote unquote, traitor to the natural horsekeeping movement. Things us naturalists have tried to demonize, these things I wrote. The fact is, I remember being at my institute in Poland where I got my horse riding instructor's license and trainer's license. I remember all the clients had gone home, and we had several transitional clients there that weekend whose horses lived in a traditional box with small paddock setting. And those horses had come for the weekend and they struggled in this wide open spaces arrangement that my school had set up. We had a fleet of bridleless school horses and everyone was outside on a forage-based diet in Poland with snow up to their hocks, no rugs. That's where I came from.
Mm-hmm.
And all of us at that school were rock solid convinced we were right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I saw these beautifully kept, well-fed, soft-bodied, soft-muscled, strong, fit horses get off a trailer, go into a box, and be a little overwhelmed with the culture shock, but overall do pretty well on their weekend course. And when those clients went home, my mentors and some of the other student teachers put their noses in the air and scoffed at the clients. Ugh, they box their horses. Ugh, how could they? It's abuse, we would say. The horses need to be... And I looked outside and it was snowing. And there were two or three horses in the herd that looked absolutely miserable. And I remember quietly thinking to myself, I wish I could give that horse a real option. Because we've made that natural horsekeeping choice for them. So I do criticize cultures where one singular thought has overtaken to the point that we criticize people who are different to us, because I know what it feels like to be criticized for being different. And I will challenge even my friends on their dogma. What does dogma mean to you?
Yeah, well, and I think that's really an important point to draw out just a little bit, because that was something that I noticed in the post too and went, oh yeah, this is good, because I personally have been the most dogmatic about the thing I'm very invested in a good handful of times. And each time, like with my learning about natural horsemanship, oh my God, rope halters are the only kind thing to use on a horse. Do you use a web halter? Oh God. Oh, I mean, that's so clunky, you know? Oh, and the whole thing, right? I mean, I have been there. That's why I can speak to it, because I've been
there. There's also the flip side of it. The people who say, the emails I used to get saying rope halters are abusive. The emails.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Because dogma is not about the particular thing. It's the vehicle. It's the way of thinking rigidly that your side is
right.
And this is a very human thing to do. It's a trap to fall into. And I think having felt the personal pain of detaching my own sense of identity from the dogmatic practices I had attached to and enmeshed within, having done that three times. And when I say that, people go, oh yeah, three times, no big deal. I'm like, no, I'm talking about literally my sense of identity from a methodology and a practice and a way of thinking. That's a really big deal. And it's not comfortable. I get why people don't want to do it. Because usually there's been some sort of, there's a reason that drives us into natural horsekeeping. A, generally we care about the horses a lot. That's why we're there. We want to do what's best for them. And often we were doing what we found out was not best for them to begin with, right? So then we transition. The transition is painful. There's, not to make it just sound like a big trauma story, but there's a lot involved with getting into this natural horsekeeping. And you see your partner struggle sometimes, right? Like you're mentioning about the blankets and rugging horses and saying, oh my gosh, this horse has such a great coat naturally given to them. And why are we putting a blanket on? And sometimes you can see that your friend actually doesn't grow a great coat because they've been genetically selected for having this really thin coat and this thin skin. And actually they now live in a different climate and maybe they would actually feel better because anyway.
Side of the question, when I kept my woolly mammoth in a desert and I clipped him and the messages I would get, why are you clipping him? Why are you clipping him? It's natural to leave him how he is because he stands there in the middle of a winter's day sweating balls. So these conversations continue, right?
So we need to be able to challenge our own deeply held beliefs.
Yeah.
When horses bring something to us that says, yes, yes, that's great for horse kind, but I'm a little gold.
But me, I'm not horse kind. I am an individual,
Yes, so being able to, to zoom out and zoom back in and look at an opinion that ruffles your own feathers and go, what about that could be true for me?
Right.
Right. So I've been on different sides of different fences, like very anti all sorts of horse disciplines. And one of the things that has really helped me move my own needle is going to something like a breed pleasure show that I don't participate in anymore and looking and saying, yeah, I know I wouldn't do that, that, and that. What is working? Why is some of this still happening? What actually is going well in these circumstances? Because I do guarantee very little in life, but I guarantee you go to any sort of horse-related thing, even one that you vehemently disagree with. If you look hard enough, you could be able to find something, even if it's just wow, the fact that horses don't disavow us as a species. So this is just a little, you know, when you've been dogmatic enough yourself in your life, and you've had that slapped back in your face by looking at horses as individuals, it becomes easier to step back and go, oh, okay. Or even, that's just one person's opinion. Scrolling on by.
Yeah, yeah. I understand that rigid frameworks and rigid thinking, rigid rules, there's a comfort in that, because my horses are turned out 24/7 and I've optimized their turnout. They're happy. There's a mental economy there, because horses are hard animals to keep alive. They're difficult to work with. There's a lot involved. We're amateur zookeepers, most of us, if horses aren't our full-time profession, right? And so I get it. Like, we need to lighten the load somewhere. Or if we're going to lighten the load anywhere, let's lighten the load on my horses are turned out, baseline, period, end of sentence. Like, I'm happy for that. I'm happy for that conversation.
Yeah.
However, what I wanted this post to do, and I think what it is ultimately going to be able to do for those who understood it, is we're moving the conversation away from 24/7 turnout, such as how many hours is the horse turned out? 12, 8, 6, 24, 7, 24/6, 24/5, what is it? Moving the conversation away from how many hours is the horse outside into what is actually happening to this indoor horse during those hours. At 1 a.m., at 2 a.m., in all seasons, can they sleep? Can they escape the weather? Can they access forage without competition, real or perceived? Can they lie down comfortably? Are their feet coping? Are insects exhausting them? Are their social relationships restorative or demanding? Do they come out of that environment with greater or diminished vitality?
Right.
That's more sophisticated than counting turnout hours, and putting them into a stable can be a tool that can solve a lot of those things. Like, I've created this track system in my home and it's beautiful. It's optimized. There's no mud. You've seen it. Mm-hmm. It's pretty gorgeous for kind of a self-build track, and it's continuing, and they're great on it. It's an essential management tool. I now consider my track is my version of a stable. It's just a very long, skinny stable.
Right. No, but absolutely.
That's my turn in. And then I was kind of looking at them going, they're sleeping, they're resting. Their hooves are strong, but woof, their hooves are pushed right to the edge, especially in winter when the sand, the anti-mud is like sandpaper on the feet. And then I'm like, you know what? I've got this beautiful like steed mats, these well-drained, soft-step rubber mats that I've got everywhere. And what if I put them here right next to the house? And then what if I like put a roof over it? And then what if I like closed it in from the wind? That would be good. But I put windows so that I could have it open in good weather. Yes, close it in from the wind. And then like let them come in. And then they are coming in. As soon as it was built, they were in there within seconds. They were in there. This strange, well-footed, walled, roofed structure close to the house. They would go in there the minute I built it. And then I was like, what if I sometimes put food in there for the ones that maybe look like they might need a break? And then what if I like closed the door? And what if I like locked it? What would change in my horse's mind if they knew for certain through routine that no one's going to bother them at this time? And I went, Lockie, I'm going to swear now. I said to myself, Lockie, that's fucking stabling, mate. You didn't invent that. That's fucking stabling, mate, Mr. Natural Guy. I went so far around the circle. And then the more I listened to my horses, they like led me, drip fed me into a stabling situation. Not for all of them and not for all the time.
That's the important point.
And now it's part of my management and they're better for it.
Yep, that is absolutely now, important.
And I've been in professional settings in the past where the horses would be experiencing structured rest and stabling. And at the time I was ambivalent about it. I'm like, I don't know if this is good for them or not. They seem pretty happy, but I wonder what would happen if we just took all the walls down and gave them the choice. You know, I remember thinking that. I remember having my nose in the air about it and being ambivalent about it. But I have extensive professional experience seeing horses in stalls, not in stalls. I've seen so many different environments all over the world, online and in person. And stabling is a consistent tool that can be used sometimes.
Sometimes. And I think one of the really important things that kind of got buried in that post that I think was just a brilliant line is the social rest without social isolation. So that's a part of stabling that is often just part and parcel, that they are isolated completely. Or maybe stalls are available somewhere, but they are completely isolated. That's not restful.
No.
And that's a whole different management tool to be able to provide.
Sure. Yeah.
Separation without isolation.
Yeah. I swear, it's been really a mind-boggling task on my property with its constraints to set up all of my shelters so that no matter which shelter an individual horse is in, if they all spread out amongst all the shelters, they all could get a line of sight to each other from every shelter they're in. We put windows in places and put shelters in places and positioned them at angles.
Yeah, which
so
is
that
amazing.
No matter where they are, there's a line of sight to another horse at all times if they choose it. Mm-hmm. So if they choose to get out of line of sight, they can. And when they choose to get out of each other's line of sight, I'm noticing it and I'm taking vitals. I'm like, are you sick? What's going on?
Interesting. Because I think that's a really important and very little noticed detail. Some horses really need plenty of time to be out of line of sight. Because remembering because my horses are all 24/7 turnout. That is what we have established here. We also do have some time each day that they come into individual pens. And that's definitely been part of the design factor that I wanted for our property. I wanted to make sure that our pastures had vanishing sight lines. There's not a space where they can stand and see every inch. And I think that's really important when we're talking about herds, because the herds are artificially constructed social groupings, right? So sometimes they're put with people that they wouldn't necessarily choose. And by people, I mean other horses. So, but that's an important point.
I've seen your place and it's beautiful across all these rolling acres. It's absolutely stunning. And you put up lots of videos and photos of your horse's environment. Mm-hmm. And your horses are all doing well, in my opinion, as far as domestic horses go. You've also got experience in track systems. And I know track systems is a buzzword. And let's not spend too much time on it because that's a whole other conversation. But those of us who know, we know the benefits of a track system. It's a perpetual treadmill situation by way of creating a long, skinny paddock around the edges of grass with multiple forage stations for horses and different shared arrangements and free choice everything and enrichment stations and all sorts of things you can do with it. It's a really beautiful way of keeping horses. It's how I choose to keep horses. You've got experience in track systems.
Yes.
What's the problem with track systems that you've noticed, and why wouldn't you choose it for your own property?
Yeah, it's an interesting one because it also, I think it varies wildly and widely by geographic region and what substrate your property is on. So here in the Wisconsin area of the Midwest, there's mud as a possibility all over the place. And I was able to be part of sort of a large experiment of a large scale track boarding place where I got to watch tracks in various stages of population and kind of what happens and what needs to be managed. So I think in order for track systems to work, there needs to be good footing so that it doesn't, you know, turn into a poor footing, tiny lot.
And good footing is very, very, very expensive. It's going to cost you more than an indoor arena. Ask me how I know.
This is the thing. This is one of the reasons why we don't. Just cost constraints. But in noticing how much movement and the type and quality of movement my horses had when they were on a track system that was very compact versus a pasture situation, I just had my eyes open to, again, this was an area that I held a dogmatic belief, and that was that pastures are bad for horses, because sometimes they are. And for some horses, they really are. And yet for some horses, they're really good. So it's currently, when I had my eyes open to the benefits of pasture versus track, I chose that for this next property that we have, well, the current property. But that requires a huge sacrifice on our part, because that requires a lot of land, a lot of land. So, you know, we have 23 acres of fenced pasture and we have 8 horses currently here. So, you know, any of these things have constraints.
Yep. Because this post, too much turnout, is really a post about constraints and capacity and what creates the push-pull around you and what you've got. And the being that's in the middle of all of this is the horse. And we can't forget that even a 24/7 turnout situation or any horse keeping situation is something we chose for them. We chose that they will have autonomy over all of their choices. What about mental fatigue? Who's ever felt mental fatigue at a menu that's too long?
Oh, absolutely.
Or who's ever felt mental fatigue just looking at equestrian world on social media? hello, we could, these things trickle into our horses. So I wanted to talk about this conversation around capacity, this conversation around constraints. And I really want people to know that I'm not saying natural horsekeeping got everything wrong. I'm saying I am one of those people. We fought for these changes. Me and my clients, my friends, my colleagues, my community, we all implemented those changes. The last horse has been turned out inside my bubble. And now that that's done, I'm noticing that this is happening. I was not trying to pull the conversation back into the past. I was trying to push it into the future. What happens when the last horse has been turned out and the advocacy work there was successful? What do we then need to advocate for? And I think that is a question about, all right, now that we've got turned out as a baseline, the advocacy work is on, how is that horse actually experiencing those hours? And does that work for them?
Right. It was an interesting thing. I think it sparked a lot of good discussion.
I hope so. And I hope it did. I'm undeterred. You know, my feeling about all of this in the background, you know that feeling when you stock your hay barn?
That's a good feeling.
The sleep you get when the hay barn's full and it's well locked and it's clean and dry and tidy and all the hay is cleaned up. That's how I feel in my work every day. The hay barn is full. So I'm having these sort of conversations based on that place. I'm glad I wrote it. Wouldn't write it the same way again. Learned a lot. And I think as we are the kind of experimentation generation for having tech fully integrated with our lives, we're going to see in the short term diminishing returns upon human interaction and human tribalism and behavior in an online space. So as people who are in the online space, we're just going to have to gird our loins, buckle our seatbelts, and be quite galvanized about how we present ideas in this space, because we're about 50 years out from actually getting a handle on this technology as a culture and actually culturally kind of controlling our behavior in the online outrage space. So we're about 50 years away from that. And I need to don't forget that.
Don't forget that.
Michelle, thanks for being with me today. I want to be respectful of your time. You need to go.
True. Thank you so much for inviting me to be able to discuss this with you and for being so candid, as you always are, honestly, about these things moving forward.
Thanks for letting me hash it out with you. Have a good day. Let me know how the lessons go. You've got a mentorship now.
I do. Lucky me.
Cool. Say hello to them for me.
I will.
All right.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Now, how do I stop? There we go. Thanks.
And that's all for today. If something in this episode made an impact on you, I encourage you to take it with you to your next moment with your horse, because that's where this work and these conversations really come alive in what you do next. If you would like to support this podcast, a simple way to do that is by leaving a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon. It would help more people to find these conversations, and it would mean a lot to me. Horse First with Lockie Phillips is the formerly Emotional Horsemanship podcast and is distributed by the Believe Audio and Video Network. And just a gentle reminder, the content of this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. The opinions expressed are those of the host and the guests and are not a substitute for professional, veterinary, or medical advice. I'm Lockie Phillips. Thank you for listening.